Okay, good. All right, well, we return after the hiatus last week because of the weather to Psalm 5. Now, Psalm 5 is about deliverance from deceivers. Now, it's part of a group of psalms, actually, where David talks about his enemies and their treatment of him and his response to them. Just a little bit of review. We've seen that this is a mourning psalm, which is very much like Psalm 4, which preceded, of course, and there's a symbolism to that. And the symbolism is that judicial decisions were rendered early in the morning. Now, to us, that may seem strange, but again, there's a symbolism there that the sun was a symbol of justice and renewed hope. And so it was very early in the morning that these judgments took place. Second thing is that David still has enemies, and the enemies are malicious liars, and that's what he calls them. Now, physical violence doesn't seem to be a factor, and so it's mainly slander that's coming from these enemies. But his consolation is that he still has access to the temple. Now, the temple, of course, was all important for the Judaism of that day. You remember that when Daniel was in exile, what did he do when he prayed? Which direction did he face?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, that's right, exactly. Because, in a sense, the prayers were channeled through the temple up to God, as it were. Now, the writer of the Hebrews says later, though, we have direct access, so we don't have to go through the temple anymore, but rather just go straight up, as it were, to God. And so the temple was all important. Now, his prayer is based on the conviction that God will defend the righteous, that God is the ultimate king, and David can appeal to him for protection. And the third thing we saw is that David focuses on the fact that he's welcome in the sanctuary, but the wicked are not. Because, quite bluntly, as David puts it, God hates wickedness. And by extension, then hates the wicked. Now, we've talked about that, and we're going to talk about it further today. And I want to come to the applications. And the first application is that the path of righteousness is often paved with unjust suffering. That's just a fact of life. But even so, David is aware that God has a ear that hears us, and he has a heart for justice. Now, that justice may be delayed, but eventually it comes. Now, the famous text in that regard is Habakkuk 2:2-4, and Paul, of course, quotes that in Romans 1:16-17. And it says, "And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain upon tablets, so that he who runs, so that he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its time, it hastens to the end, it will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it, it will surely come, it will not delay. Behold, he whose soul is not upright in him shall fail, but the righteous shall live by his faithfulness, as we've seen before. That Hebrew word, emunah. It's often translated faith, but it's always it contains the notion of faithfulness. And so there can never be true faith apart from steadfast faithfulness. All right, so deliverance may be slow in coming, and when we're waiting for it, it's always slow, isn't it? If you're waiting for something to happen. When you were kids, you know, you could measure the passage of time from one Christmas to another. And it seemed to be so long back then. These days, it's very short.
Yeah, it's shorter every
day. It does, yeah, exactly right. And so, then we are to wait for God's deliverance. And that means that the righteous may pray with confidence for deliverance from deceitful and malicious attacks. Because God himself hates wickedness. Now, if this is what we've experienced, we're in good company. There's Matthew 5:11-12. Blessed are you when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so men persecuted the prophets who were before you. And so if deliverance doesn't come immediately or even soon, we look to the day of Christ as our vindication. Now, there's always going to be those who want to degrade us, who want to defame us, even destroy us. And that's just the reality, I'm afraid. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't take insults really very easily. Mm-hmm. And that's the worst thing you can do, really. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words never hurt me. Well, they do. They hurt on the emotional level very much so. But we hang in, we persevere, because the day is coming then when vindication is going to take place. And there's nothing wrong with seeking vindication. It's Christ himself who was vindicated. Paul says in 1 Timothy that he was vindicated in or by the Spirit. And so his resurrection was his vindication. His enemies, of course, thought that he deserved to die. He was like the reprobate son of Deuteronomy 18. And so he was treated that way as though he were an apostate from the covenant. The incorrigible son, the parents can't do anything with him. And so they take him to the elders and they administer a very rough kind of justice, stoning to death. At least in principle that would have happened. And so Jesus was regarded then as being just that. A glutton and a drunkard, it was called. And that's the way the reprobate son is described in Deuteronomy, as being a glutton and a drunkard. And so he was treated that way. And so if it's going to happen to the master of the household, it's certainly going to happen to us as well. Because we're no better than he was, to be sure, not nearly as good. Now, modern psychology makes a distinction between one's person and one's deeds. But Scripture says that one who does evil things is an evil person. That those two things always go together. Now, that's why God's hatred of evil and his hatred of the evil person are one and the same. Of many passages we might cite, there's Deuteronomy 7, 6 through 11. And it says, "For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, else he has chosen you then to be his own possession." Then it comes on to say, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments to a thousand generations, and requites to their face those who hate him by destroying them. He will not be slack with him who hates him. He will requite him to his face. You shall therefore be careful to do the commandments and the statutes and the ordinances which I command you this day." Now, that's pretty tough-sounding stuff. But that's just the reality of it. There are those who have set themselves against the Lord, and so it is that he will requite them, if not in this life, then certainly in the day of judgment. Now, you think about the stuff that's going on in our day. And we just had a more recent example of it yesterday, where the politicians, you know, they rail against one another, and especially those who would deny same-sex marriage, that kind of thing. And it's becoming now just the order of the day, is it not? If you don't embrace that, if you don't embrace climate change and all the other things that go with it, well, then you know, you're not a good citizen. You're a bad person. And so it's such as those that God hates because they hate him. They hate his will. They hate his commandments. Now, we can add to that Hebrews 1:9, which is a quotation of Psalm 45. "Thou hast loved righteousness and hated lawlessness. Therefore, God thy God has anointed thee with the oil of gladness beyond thy comrades." Now, there are those who would claim that this falls short of the New Testament ethic of loving one's enemies. And so, how do we reconcile that with a passage like Matthew 5:43-48? "You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be the sons of your Father who is in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain to the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even tax collectors do the same?" Now, you couldn't be any worse than a tax collector in first century Judaism. Because, of course, they were agents for the Romans, and the Romans required a certain amount, and then the tax collectors, they would gouge as much as they could and keep the rest for themselves. And so the Romans allowed them to do that. "Give us our share, then, you know, you can have anything you want above and beyond that." And they did just that. "And if you salute only your brethren, what are you doing more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" And so pagans do that. And so what makes you any better? You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now the reference there is to perfect in love. Now perfect love is that which takes into account indeed the faults, the sins of others, but loves them anyway. Now when David writes in Psalm 5, he has in mind those who have deliberately set themselves against the Lord's anointed, and therefore against the Lord himself, that they are the avowed enemies of both. And remember that the historical backdrop to this psalm, like Psalm 3, is Absalom's rebellion. But I think Matthew 5 has to be understood in its historical context, and we always have to do that. Recent scholarship these days has emphasized that and has rightly emphasized it. Now, the gist of it is that Judaism had divided into various enclaves. You know, we have the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Then you have that group out by the Dead Sea, the Qumran community. The New Testament doesn't mention them for some reason, but they were very much active and alive at that point in time. And so they had divided themselves into these groups, and if you didn't belong to a particular group, especially the Pharisees, then you were excluded from the community of salvation. You had to belong to us in order to be a saved person. And so an extreme sectarianism was evident in those days. And so the wrath of God was upon all who didn't belong to the right group. And that's what gave rise to the tradition, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Does Scripture say that anywhere? Not at all. But that was the saying that arose. That was the application that they made of the love command. And so if you love your neighbor, well, it must follow then that you hate your enemy. But of course, that doesn't follow at all. Now, that can be illustrated in documents that stem from what we call the Second Temple period. First Temple, of course, was destroyed by the Babylonians, and the Second Temple, built by Zerubbabel, and that was in existence until 70 AD when it came down as well. And for essentially the same reason. Israel was taken off into captivity because of idolatry. And then when it came to the Second Temple, essentially that is the case as well. Because when you read Stephen's speech, for example, in Acts 7, he says that they had turned the temple into a house made with hands. And we might say, well, how else could it be made if not by hands? Had to be. Yeah, that's right. But that phrase, made with hands, was current in the Judaism of that day for a pagan temple or an idol. And so when Stephen utters that, he says effectively, you are the idolaters, you have turned the temple into an idol. Well, that was enough. They couldn't take any more than that. And so that's why they grabbed hold of him, threw him down, and stoned him with stones. And of course it was Saul who was consenting to Stephen's death. And so they took something that was meant to be access to God, the worship of God, and turned it into what was an idol, effectively. And so we can turn anything into an idol, can we not? That's why John says, little children, keep yourselves from idols, whatever it may be. And there are lots of them. Now, that can be illustrated from certain documents, again, stemming from the Second Temple period. And to appreciate what's going on, we have to take into account what's called the theology of zeal in the intertestamental period, roughly 200 years. See, in one sense, Israel had been cured of idolatry. They no longer bowed down to graven images. But at the same time, as we said, they turned their tradition into an idol. Now, during that period, we have the Maccabean Zealots. And they were the forerunners of that group that actually bore that name in the New Testament period. And so, indeed, they were zealous for the law. They're consistently marked out as being defenders of the Jewish way of life. And, of course, that was articulated by the law of Moses. And that's what they should have done at that time. And not only were they ready to die for the purity of the covenant, as many of them did, have those gruesome martyr stories in the books of Maccabees. Well, not just that, they were also willing to kill for the purity of the covenant. Not just to die, but to kill. Now, there is a passage in 1 Maccabees. It talks about the way that the king's officers, they were enforcing the apostasy. They gruesomely treated mothers who had their male sons circumcised. They would kill the sons, the infants, and tie them around the mother's neck. Gruesome stuff, to be sure. Well, there was an inevitable reaction to that, to be sure. I'm told in chapter 2 of 1 Maccabees, when he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar of Modin, according to the king's command. When Mattathias saw it, now Mattathias was the father of Judas Maccabeus and the other Maccabee brothers. He was a priest. When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal, and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to his righteous anger, and he ran and killed him upon the altar. This one who was offering the idolatrous sacrifice. And at the same time, he killed the king's officer, who was forcing them to sacrifice, tore down the altar. Thus he burned with zeal for the law, as Phinehas did against Zimri, the son of Salu. That's a reference to Psalm 106. That it was Phinehas, there was this couple engaged in sex, and illicitly, of course. And so Phinehas took the sword and rammed it through both of them. And Psalm 106 celebrates that he burned the zeal. Well, and this Mattathias, he did the same thing. Then he cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me." And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the city. And that's the beginning of what we call the Maccabean revolt. Well, then that mentality held over into the first century period. And so if anyone messes with the law, then you deal harshly with them. And of course, a prime example of that was Saul of Tarsus. We've seen in Galatians before that Paul said, "I was so zealous for the law, so zealous for the traditions of the fathers." Not just the law itself, but all the traditions that had been and that had surrounded it by way of interpretation of the law. And of course, the law has to be interpreted, no doubt. But they interpreted in Maccabean terms, in terms of zeal. Now, there was a Jewish philosopher named Philo, you've probably heard that name, who was roughly contemporary with Paul. And it's Philo who talks about zealots for the law. And they were merciless, he says, to anyone who would subvert the ancestral ways. And Philo speaks of that in glowing terms. There's a funny story about Philo, who led a delegation to Rome to raise concerns to Caligula about the way the Jews were being treated. And right in the middle of the speech, Caligula shouts out, "Why don't you eat pork?" Which had nothing to do with the discourse, you know. But Caligula was nuts anyway, so that's to say the least. And so I'm sure Philo was caught off guard with that. Nope. As anyone would be.
What am I doing?
Yeah, exactly so. Yeah. Now you have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And they regard the righteous person as one, to quote, who was to bear unremitting hatred toward all men of ill repute. Unremitting hatred. They're not part of our group, and especially the Romans, but really all others as well. They at the Dead Sea, they referred to the Pharisees. Now, we think of the Pharisees as being real sticklers for the law. But according to one of the scrolls, the Pharisees are the seekers of smooth things. In other words, they look for easy interpretations and applications of the law. So when you read through the Dead Sea Scrolls, you can see that they really were sticklers for the traditions that had really encumbered the law. Now, the founder of the sect was called the Teacher of Righteousness. And one scholar said that he was full of warm affection for his community, full also of irreconcilable hatred for his opponents. And that's the context in which the New Testament is written. Now, John Piper points out, just to quote, he says, in spite of the sectaries, that is, the sectarian's willingness to pursue his enemies with good deeds, it is hate for the outsider that brings satisfaction. Another scholar, Scott McKnight, points out that the verb pursue throughout the Dead Sea Scrolls has a negative end in view. In other words, you pursue your enemies with good deeds so as to increase their judgment in the day of judgment. So be kind to them, be good in that sense, because it's all going to be hammered over their head in the day of judgment. And so it's in that context then that the New Testament speaks in terms of loving one's enemies. And there's another scholar, a Jewish scholar, who wrote about Pharisaism and said it was a belligerent movement that knew how to hate. And that's coming from a Jewish person. A belligerent movement that knew how to hate. Now, it's that theology of zeal that came to a head in what we call the War of Independence, the Jewish Revolt, and it was provoked by the Zealots. And Bickerman again says that the use of violence became a sacred duty. And so, those who were zealous for the law, to those who were zealous for the law, Christianity appeared to be a subversive movement. Why, you want to do away with the law, or at least you want to modify it. And that's the reason why it was rejected by so many first century Jews. It seemed to be a frontal attack on the traditions, on Scripture itself. And unless you've been given discernment by the Spirit to recognize the truth, then you would have drawn the same conclusion. I would have drawn the same conclusion. These guys are just out then to undermine everything we believe and we hold dear and sacred. And again, Paul himself was such a zealot. He's described in those terms by himself and in the book of Acts. There's a Korean scholar named Seon Kim who points out that Paul's pre-Christian zeal was stirred by nothing other than the scandal of the cross. It says Paul must have judged the Christian proclamation of the crucified Jesus as the Messiah to be a blasphemy against God. For in his view, God cannot possibly have made him the Messiah whom he had cursed. Cannot have a Messiah who bears God's curse. Cannot. But that's exactly what happened. And so that's why, on that level, the gospel was always offensive. Was and is to Judaism. The claim that Jesus was the Messiah was to attribute self-contradiction to God. So Paul the Zealot, for God's honor, was compelled to persecute Christians. He says Deuteronomy 21:23 must have been a catchphrase of Paul when he went about persecuting the Christians. And that text says, if a man has committed a crime punishable by death, he is to be put to death and you hang him on a tree. And so it's the dead body which is affixed to the tree for the whole day, and passers-by and see this is one who is under God's curse. And so that's the way Jesus is treated, but with one significant difference, which is what? Well, that's right, he did. But the big difference is that he was alive when he was affixed to the tree. Whereas the apostate in Deuteronomy is the body that's affixed to the tree. And so there is that difference. Well, now it's in that historical context, all of this, that Jesus demands that we love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us, so that we may be the sons and daughters of our Father who is in heaven. And so that's really what provides the impact to those words. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? And in Galatians 5 and 6, as we saw some months ago, Paul makes the same demand. He talks about faith working through love. for the whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, take heed that you're not consumed by one another. Now that's the language we saw before of a dog fight, or animals attacking one another. And so things had degenerated in Galatia to the extent that they were no longer acting like human beings. They were acting like a bunch of wild dogs attacking one another. Now, the practical application comes when we go about the work of restoring those who have sinned, Galatians 6, 1-5. And again, we saw that. Paul says that correction is to take place in the spirit of gentleness. And so someone sins, and it may be a grievous sin, and maybe something becomes very public. Well, the response to it, at least the first response, is not to go around, bad-mouthing that person or taking a harsh attitude and a stance toward him, but rather, it's in the spirit of gentleness that all of that is to take place. Now, in with a quote from Calvin. He says, just as ambition is a particularly poisonous evil, so also great harm is done by unseasonable and excessive severity, which goes under the noble name of zeal, but frequently springs from pride and dislike and contempt of the brethren. Now, that's well said, and it's very insightful. For very many harass their brethren voluntarily and cruelly, as if their faults were something to taunt them with. The reason is that they would rather scold than correct. And there are a lot of those around who rather scold than correct. Those who sin should be reproved, and it is often necessary to be severe and sharp. Therefore, it is right to press them with rebukes, even to the point of discourtesy. But the vinegar must be tempered with oil. Therefore, he teaches us to show mildness in correcting the faults of brethren, and says that no rebukes are godly and Christian which do not savor of meekness. And again, that's very well said. There comes a point when excommunication perhaps becomes a reality, but it's always the last resort. There's always seeking to restore those who have fallen one way or the other. Welcome. We take any questions for you.